Sometimes, the last place you look for a monster is the first place he strikes. University, an oasis of learning and personal discovery. And the perfect place for a predator. By the time you see him, it's too late.
Very egotistical, self-centered individual who was very intelligent, he's very cunning. However, he's not safe to be in the community. We have no idea who he is. We have no idea where he's from.
In true crime, investigation and conviction may take years. But every detective knows that the crucial clue is always there. Somewhere in the first 72 hours. A frat house on the edge of a university campus. Halifax, Nova Scotia, 1998.
I was on call that night for major crime. Shortly after 7 a.m., I got called to my residence to come in, and I went directly to the scene. The information I had was a serious sexual assault.
The victim, 19-year-old Janet Piercy, has been taken to hospital. The room suggests a violent struggle.
My thought when I looked in the room, this person lives at this address. Therefore, this is an attack that took place in his home. To me, as an investigator, that tells me that that is a high-risk situation for the offender. It's just screaming out, this is not my first time.
Detective Martin interviews Dave Murphy, a student who actually witnessed the assault. He says he was woken around 4 a.m. by screams. He rushed downstairs and saw his friend, Ian Green, struggling with a young woman. Green assured him that it was just a quarrel, nothing to worry about. He started back to bed when it suddenly hit him. This woman was in trouble. Green fled the room.
Green! Call 911, somebody!
Nobody's seen him since. Murphy says Green is a good friend of his and a brilliant pre-med student. Everybody likes him. He has a girlfriend whom he treats with kid gloves. Murphy can't believe that this is the same person he saw commit such a brutal attack.
To attack somebody is one thing. To go to such a high-risk level of attack, well, it's either somebody that's out of control or somebody who has progressed so far that it's not a big deal to them anymore. Either way is a very dangerous situation for citizens and for people in the area.
Green has vanished. Detective Martin puts out an all-points bulletin. And he puts Green's girlfriend's house under surveillance. Then he pays a visit to the victim, Janet Piercy, to get her side of the story. She tells the detective how she met Green that night for the first time at the frat party. He was charming and easy to talk to. She felt he was a really nice guy. When the party broke up, he invited her to another party upstairs. There was no party. Green had other plans, but she wasn't interested, and when she went to use his phone to call a cab, he suddenly turned on her. When she tried to get away, he became even more enraged. She surely would have killed her if that one guy had not come to her rescue. Late that afternoon, the surveillance of the girlfriend's house pays off. Green is arrested and brought into custody for questioning. During the interview, Green is calm.
Very, very intelligent. When he was confronted with, you know, there are witnesses that saw you beat this woman in the hallway, he would just completely ignore it. He wouldn't acknowledge the fact that he was faced with this situation. He would clam up, not say anything. However, as soon as you took him off topic, he started talking and never stopped.
His favorite topic is himself.
He is from Ross River in the Yukon Territories. His father died a few years ago in a motor vehicle accident, taking him to a junior A hockey game. So that was a very tragic event for him that he's still having difficulty coming to terms with. And his mother just recently died in a house fire. It's as a result of this that it's just so traumatic to him that he has to geographically leave the area because it's too painful to stay there.
But there is something about Green that nags at Martin.
He had a very compelling story as far as one that would gather sympathy or at the very least empathy. However, he's trying to pass himself off as 19 years of age, and there's no way that this man I'm talking to is 19 years of age. He's charged with the assault that took place on the young woman in the frat house. He's held for court on those charges.
Martin immediately sends Green's clothes to the lab for forensic analysis. That night, Martin gets a surprise. There are no police records of Green's parents' deaths. In fact, there are no records of them at all.
If I could describe his lies, I'd describe them as having both feet planted firmly in midair. There's no substance to the stories that he tells. However, he's very convincing at it. He's extremely convincing at it.
The following day, Martin obtains a search warrant for Green's room.
We're looking for clothing and identifications belonging to the victim. I found this white plastic bag, and what came out of that was a purse and a wallet. When I saw the wallet, I was very shocked.
Martin had presumed that they belonged to the victim, Janet Piercy, but the ID is for Atara McDonald.
When I saw the name, I realized exactly who it was.
The case of Tara McDonald is well known to the Halifax police.
This February crime was a very, very vicious beating with a baseball bat that took place in the middle of the day in a very busy city street.
Tara McDonald was alone, working in a thrift shop. Her attacker walked in and savagely beat her for no apparent reason.
Coma, was in hospital for a very prolonged period of time, had brain surgery, several metal plates had to be put into her head as a result of being beaten by a baseball bat.
But after her recovery, a schizophrenic had confessed to the assault and was put in jail. In the same bag, Martin finds another piece of ID. This one for a Lucy Taylor, a woman Martin has never heard of. So what does Green have to do with Tara McDonald? And who is Lucy Taylor? Martin requisitions Ian Thor Green's student records, looking for any history of violence towards women. There are no records of any offenses. In fact, there is no Ian Thor Green registered at the university at all. After 72 hours, Martin has a man in custody who has brutally assaulted one woman and possibly more. A convincing liar who Martin fears is a serial offender.
To me as an investigator, that scares me. Because what type of a creature am I dealing with here?
Detective Tom Martin has Ian Thor Green in custody for the violent assault on Janet Piercy. But he's sure there is more to Green's past than he is letting on. Martin calls Lucy Taylor, the woman whose ID he found in Green's room. He wants to find out how Lucy knows Green and why he had her purse in his room. Lucy tells the detective she has never heard of Ian Thor Green. But she was violently attacked after leaving a bar 5 weeks ago. She was knocked down from behind in the parking lot by a complete stranger. While she was lying helpless on the ground, he masturbated on her. He fled when some people scared him off. Martin thinks Green is responsible for all three attacks on the women, but he needs proof. He goes back to the frat house to talk to Green's friends and find out more about Green's personality and, most importantly, his relationships with women.
His friends told me that he categorized women in one of two ways. Either they were like angels or they were trash. And the ones that he dated, where he was a perfect gentleman, these are the women that he categorized as the angels. And the trashy ones are the women who went to bars, the women who wore the skimpy clothing or who danced in a certain way.
Martin requests the security camera tape from the bar the night Lucy Taylor was attacked. The officers who investigated Lucy's case saw nothing unusual on the tape. But when Martin views it, he identifies Green leaving just a few moments after Lucy. He notices something else. The jacket Green was wearing is the same one he had on the day of his arrest. Martin has Green's clothes tested again, this time for traces of Lucy Taylor. The results of the DNA tests are good news. The jacket shows traces of Lucy's blood. But there's more. Even though 5 months have passed since Tara McDonald was viciously attacked with a baseball bat, her blood has been found on Green's pants. Martin has irrefutable evidence that the creature he has caught is a serial offender. But Ian Thor Green still refuses to answer any questions about why he attacked the women. Martin turns for help to forensic psychiatrist Peter Collins.
These people will lie and will deceive others and think nothing of it. They divide the world as to those people who they feel they can take advantage of. And if they're taken advantage of, it's their own fault. So they can rationalize and justify their victimizations of others and really don't feel any empathy for victims and can continue on.
If Green did not care about his victims, why did he keep their purses and IDs?
More than likely, he kept the purses as souvenirs. And most often than not, these souvenirs are used as masturbatory aids, part of their deviant fantasy when they think back to what they did to the victims.
Collins' conclusion after examining Green's case is chilling.
He's a psychopath, a typical psychopath, who unfortunately also was sexually deviant. The combination of psychopathy and sexual deviance is a lethal combination.
Martin posts photographs of Green throughout Halifax, hoping to hear from anyone who's had encounters with him. He gets a call from an unlikely source. A Catholic priest tells Martin he recognizes the photo of Green. 2 years ago, this man came to his church asking for financial help. He said he was a medical student who had fallen on hard times. The church repeatedly helped this young man over a period of 2 years. But the priest knows the young man as Corey Callahan. Martin is completely at a loss. He collects Green's mail from the frat house and discovers he has not only one alias, but many.
We have no idea who he is. We have no idea where he's from. How are we going to identify this guy? Fingerprints aren't doing it. Pictures aren't doing it. Military was checked. Interpol was checked. FBI was checked. Everyone was checked. If come the end of the week, he still refuses to tell us, I'm going to have to put his picture on the media. and send it hopefully across the country and see if anyone can identify him.
As the week passes, Green's photo is broadcast on the national news.
It was late that night or in the early morning hours, and I got a phone call from our communication center saying there's a detective from upstate New York that wants to talk to you.
His name is Frank Coney. He's recognized the photo as a man named William Shrubsall.
Frank said, without question of a doubt, who you have there is William Chandler Shrubsall. He was a wanted felon who skipped out on his trial back in 96 and hasn't been seen since.
Coney tells Martin he'd better come down to Niagara Falls, New York. He's got a story to tell that's much stranger than fiction. July 1998. Detective Tom Martin travels to Niagara Falls, New York to meet investigator Frank Coney, who has identified Ian Thor Green as the escaped felon William Shrubsall. Martin is determined to gather all the evidence he can to put Shrubsall away as a dangerous offender. Coney tells Martin, William Shrubsall was an only child who had lost his father at a young age and had a domineering mother who doted on him. He was a bright student, chosen to be class valedictorian. He was a 17-year-old golden boy in love with his first girlfriend. There was only one problem. His mother didn't approve of girlfriends. She taught him that his reach should exceed his grasp and that he was destined for a better future than everyone else. Girlfriends would just get in the way.
She always wanted the best out of him. I mean, he was highly educated. He was a valedictorian. And that's what she was looking forward to for the next day.
On the night of June 25th, 1988, his mother wanted him to help her prepare the food for his graduation party. But Shrubsall wanted to go out with his girlfriend. His mother became enraged.
He made threats to him that she was going to call the girlfriend, tell him to stay away from him, leave him alone. And that's when everything exploded.
Who do you think you are? You're not going to call him. You are not going to call him.
Police were called to the scene that night and found the body of Shrubsall's mother.
Her face, you couldn't recognize her face. It was badly battered. There was a wooden baseball bat laying next to her, covered in blood. That was a horrible crime. I mean, that's your biological mother. I mean, that was his family. Within an hour, he did give a confession that he did assault his mother with the baseball bat, that she was always yelling at him, always on his back, and he just couldn't take it anymore. He showed no remorse. It didn't bother him at all. The girlfriend started crying, and he says, well, what's the big thing here? This is no big thing.
Coney tells Martin that Shrubsall was tried as an adult, and he was sentenced to 15 years for manslaughter. But his lawyer successfully appealed because of Shrubsall's age.
It was reversed. They granted him youthful offender. And he only ended up spending 16 months in jail, which was devastating to us.
After he was released, Shrubsall went on to study at an Ivy League university, where he began a pattern of assaulting young women. But he was never charged. In 1996, Shrubsall returned home to Niagara Falls, where he was caught by police after he allegedly sodomized a 17-year-old girl. The day before his trial, he wrote his aunt a suicide note saying that he was throwing himself into the falls. Within days, Shrubsall surfaced in Halifax and was reborn as Ian Thor Green. The brilliant pre-med student and psychopath who had found a new hunting ground. Back in Halifax, Detective Martin contacts Shrubsall's three victims. Lucy Taylor, Janet Piercy, and Tara McDonald. He needs their testimonies to get Shrubsall declared a dangerous offender.
They all banded together and they all came through it. And it was the support and the cooperation and the desire to help that was amazing.
It was the discovery in the first 24 hours of the investigation of Tara and Lucy's IDs in the same room where Janet Piercy was attacked that led Martin to retrace the predator's tracks, uncovering his true identity and monstrous history. In December 2001, Shrubsall is classified a dangerous offender, meaning life in prison with no chance of parole.
This man is, in fact, a danger to society, will remain a danger to society, and has little, if any, outlook of not being a danger to society.
But even behind bars, Shrubsall follows his late mother's advice, finding a way for his reach to exceed his grasp. A year after his conviction, Shrubsall changes his name once more, this time legally, to Simon Templar, the fictitious hero of the TV series The Saint. He continues his life as a predator, hunting innocent young women in cyberspace. The stories on 72 Hours are true. The detectives and forensic scientists are the ones who actually worked on the case. The names of the victims are fictitious. The names of the convicted are real.